This is Conversations in Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, we're actually not here today. We're both on holiday. So this will be a good time to do a recap of some of the highlights of our show. You know, it's almost a year since we first started the show, so we have an anniversary soon to come up.
And it's been very exciting and a lot of fun to do this. And certainly we have had tremendous material to work with in this year of health reform. So we're off for a little R&R and look forward to seeing you in September. You know, we've been planning an episode on the Veteran Affairs healthcare system since we began the show back last September. We have an excellent VA system here in Connecticut. And of course, we participate every year in the Veterans Stand Down for Homeless Vets here in Connecticut. But I'm pleased today to announce we have Undersecretary of Health for the VA, Dr. Robert Petzl, here today to speak with us about the VA system and the quality revolution it went through in the 1990s and what the VA system today can teach us about transforming healthcare. And of course, we'll be talking with him about the new demands that need to be addressed for today's returning women and men from Iraq and Afghanistan.
No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded. Or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Dr. Petzl, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The administration stepped up efforts last week to ensure that consumers receive the most value for their healthcare dollars. The Department of Health announced $46 million in grant awards to states to help them crack down on unreasonable health insurance premium hikes. 45 states plus the District of Columbia will receive $1 million each to help improve oversight and make the market more consumer-friendly. Although many states have some rate review process already in place, most lack the resources to exercise it effectively. Liz Fowler, a policy director from the Department of Health and Human Services, said the goal is to give states the tools to protect consumers.
These grants will give states the ability to look more closely at what's going on in your premium insurance increases. And so in some states, they'll have the ability to reject the rates if the premiums are unjustified, if the increases are not considered to be justified. This will also mean that there's more public scrutiny of the rates. They'll be reported publicly on a website. So states will, or insurance companies will be required to report premium increases to the Secretary of HHS and to the states in which they operate. And it'll give all of us a chance to, I think, look more carefully at premiums and why they're going up.
Grant applications were submitted in early June, and states have proposed using the funding not only for things like making more information publicly available, but also creating more legislative authority for review. The health insurance premium review grants are an additional way the Affordable Care Act aims to reduce unreasonable premium increases by insurance companies. Under the new law, HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has the authority to review justifications for unreasonable increases in premiums and make them public if states choose not to participate. There are also the rules surrounding how much insurance companies must spend on medical costs versus administrative expenses or profits. Secretary Sebelius is waiting for the National Association of Insurance Commissioners to suggest rules surrounding the medical loss ratio regulation. The new healthcare law says that insurers will generally be required to spend at least 80% of consumers' premium dollars on medical care services and quality improvement activities, therefore limiting their spending on things like marketing and profits. But many unresolved issues surround the medical loss ratio regulation. Foremost, how federal tax dollars will be factored into the calculation. Insurers are also worried that the overly rigid medical loss ratio rules could drive them out of business and slow down efforts to improve quality. HHS will have the ultimate say before a regulation is finalized. The NAIC report is expected in the next few weeks. And more news for Medicare recipients. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services announced last week that monthly premiums for prescription drug plans will go up from $29 this year to $30 next year. And Medicare enrollees can expect lower out-of-pocket charges when they reach that prescription drug gap known as the donut hole. This week on Conversations on Healthcare, we're looking to the Veterans Health Administration as a model system of care. As psychological stress becomes more prevalent among returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, VA hospitals around the country are figuring out better ways to understand, diagnose, and treat mental health disorders for returning soldiers. According to a study by researchers at Stanford University, one-third of the 1.9 million men and women who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan have suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. It's the most prevalent mental health problem for today's veteran. At San Francisco's VA Medical Center, Dr. Karen Seal, a leading PTSD researcher, started the Operation Iraqi Freedom Integrated Care Clinic, which provides primary care, mental health, and social services to Iraq and Afghanistan veterans in one single setting. Dr. Seal is trying to encourage veterans to see a therapist, since most shy away from it. One study she conducted for the Journal of Traumatic Stress found that among vets who did receive a PTSD diagnosis through a VA clinic, 90% didn't complete a course of treatment. The Integrated Care Clinic opened in 2007, and today, almost 100 vets come in to receive treatment. A team of three doctors, including Dr. Seal, combat specialists, physical therapists, pain experts, and neuropsychologists, work together to help vets feel better and to cope with their illness better. Dr. Seal believes primary care doctors need help treating a younger clientele with different stresses than wars past. Currently, her clinic is working on making an instructional video to help primary care doctors learn what to do when a young veteran exhibits signs of PTSD. The clinic is also studying computerized cognitive processing therapy, a series of brain fitness exercises. With the help of the clinic and Dr. Seal's research, the San Francisco VA has added several dozen mental health clinicians in the last few years, and it's also helping them become a national hub for PTSD research.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Robert Petzl, Undersecretary of Health in the Veterans Health Administration in the Department of Veterans Affairs. Welcome, Doctor. You've directed several VA medical centers in the Midwest before you were appointed Undersecretary of Health in 2009. So you witnessed the transformation in quality at the Veterans Health Administration during the 90s that made it the revered health system it is today. In studies published in peer-reviewed journals, the VA beats other healthcare providers on virtually every measure of quality: patient safety, adherence to evidence-based medicine, coordination of care, cost-effectiveness, and patient satisfaction. What propelled the VA quality revolution, and have you been able to sustain those gains?
That's an excellent question, Mark. There were a number of things, I think, that were responsible for this back in the middle 90s. Number one is there was this tremendous sense of urgency. The VA did not have a very good reputation for quality at the time, so that everybody was poised to do something. Congress was supportive. The administration was supportive. The elements, I think, that led to this were several. One is that there was a decentralization of authority, if you will, and decision-making out of Washington into what we call the networks, the 22 regional networks that the Veterans Health Administration had just established. Two is that we began to develop a set of metrics, sets of ways to measure quality and safety well ahead of the rest of the country. This was something that was really quite new. A third is that a series of clinical practice guidelines, that is, our guidance as to what should be done and how care should be delivered in certain circumstances, particularly with chronic diseases, were promulgated within the Veterans Health Administration. Fourth, is that we developed a performance management system where senior executives within the Veterans Health Administration were held responsible for achieving certain levels of performance in terms of quality, as well as a number of other things. I think the fifth thing is that there was definitely committed leadership who believed that this organization could establish itself as an organization of excellence. So in my mind, those were the major things that contributed. Have we been able to sustain this? Yes, we have. And the question then, of course, is why have we been, or how have we been able to? Again, I think there are a number of reasons. And probably most importantly is that people within the organization now do believe, indeed, that we are an organization characterized by excellence. There's a tremendous amount of pride in that, and a tremendous amount of pride in maintaining that reputation.
The VA system, as you said, relies on evidence-based guidelines and protocols, both for preventive health services and for chronic disease management, and I'm sure for acute care as well. But central to the preventive and chronic disease services is the reliance on a primary care provider for each patient and a robust electronic health record. And of course, these are two of the key elements of high-performance care that the federal health reform bill emphasizes. All through the spring, one of the big questions asked was, will investing in these measures now reduce health care costs down the road? Can you share any outcome data from the VA that might inform the country now as we begin to make similar large investments in these areas? Have you been able to show reduced expenditures as a result of these transformations?
Yes, we have. There are a couple of examples of that. There was a recent article published as a result of a study done by a group from Harvard of our computerized medical record, looking at both the cost of implementing it and cost of operating it, as well as the potential savings that we've achieved. And their conclusion was that over the last 10 years, we have saved about $2.2 billion as a result of the computerized medical record. The capacity to follow data over time, the capacity to make decisions that are based on evidence, has led to probably fewer hospitalizations, fewer clinic visits, and other things that have saved money. We are a very good example of what can be achieved with an electronic medical record. We are now developing what I would call a new model of care for our primary care providers, trying to integrate all of the elements that we have available: telehome health, telemedicine, case management, primary care visits, group visits, the services that are available in the community, and provide a patient-centered, continuously improving, team care-delivered health experience for our patients in primary care. And I think that when this is developed, it's going to be an excellent example of how a system ought to be organized and how it ought to be delivering care.
Dr. Petzl, in 1999, the VA formed the National Center for Patient Safety to enhance safety standards. We've had Dr. Peter Pronovost on our show, who pioneered the checklist to reduce infections and errors. Have you implemented this type of checklist and seen similar results in decreased mortality and complications?
Yes, we've had Peter actually talk to us on a number of occasions, and we have in our intensive care units, particularly where central lines are generally put in, mm-hmm. we have implemented the central line bundle, it's called, which is a description of the process and the procedures that one ought to use. And we've shown a dramatic diminution of central line infections over the last several years as a result of that. In addition to that, there are a number of other things. The ventilator bundle is a guideline for how to wean patients off of ventilators, and we've dramatically decreased the hospital-acquired pulmonary infections in our intensive care units as a result of that.
I've been very impressed with the provider and team-level reports that I've seen from the VA that look at everything from patient satisfaction to access to both the process measures what we did and also the outcome measures, how well the patient did. And you referenced it as really holding managers and the senior execs accountable. But my question is, have you seen this also as fundamental to driving change in the individual provider behavior, and not just the provider, but everybody else on the team, the nurses, medical assistants, receptionists, behavioralists?
We do an excellent job of providing very comprehensive data at the network level, at the national level, and at the facility level. We have work to do yet to make sure that we get that, make that data available at the individual team, individual provider function, because I think it's fundamentally important. If you're going to ask people to continuously improve the way they do their work, which is what we're doing, then you have to provide them with data about the four domains of healthcare value: cost, quality, access, and satisfaction. And we're not as far along, in my mind, as we need to be. Now, the metrics that we have and that we use for performance management, you know, could be viewed as having sort of two fundamental functions. One of them is to provide for accountability. That is, you want to see how well the organization, perhaps individual people, are doing in their work. But in my mind, the more important thing these are able to help us with is to drive the organization forward.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Robert Petzl, Undersecretary of Health in the Veterans Health Administration at the Department of Veterans Affairs. It's true that advances in medical technology have saved more lives of those injured in combat, but it's also true that many of those men and women live in serious trauma that debilitates them psychologically. What more needs to be done to expand mental health counseling and services for vets?
Well, the Veterans Health Administration has really, I think, stepped up to the plate in terms of the needs of returning veterans. There's a relative percentage of people that come out of combat who have problems with PTSD, anxiety, depression, sometimes substance abuse, and we have instituted, first of all, a series of screening programs where every returning combat veteran that sees us is screened for substance abuse, depression, PTSD, and mild to moderate traumatic brain injury. Those people who screen positive on any one of those entities are then moved into a more in-depth evaluation and eventually treatment if needed. In addition to that, those people that have one of those problems are assigned a case manager who follows their progress, is available to them, and sees that they're getting the things that they need. I think, in my mind, what primarily needs to be done, first of all, is to understand the genesis of these issues or problems arising out of the combat experience. And research needs to be done on whether or not we can predict with any accuracy the kinds of people that will have problems associated with combat as opposed to those that don't seem to have. That's one. Two is that we need to do everything that we can to get these patients to us. Our biggest problem, I think, is the fact that not every veteran has contacted us. Not every veteran seeks our help. And, you know, these are young individuals who feel themselves to be invulnerable, immortal, and can't understand the nature of the problems that they might potentially have. And we have worked with local providers, local veteran service officers, and families to help them understand the kinds of things that they could identify and maybe help bring these veterans to us if indeed they need help.
And Dr. Petzl, at a time when so many communities and practices are worried about being able to recruit and retain primary care providers, I understand, at least here in the Northeast, that's just not a problem for the VA. And in fact, the VA is seen as a choice career opportunity for young physicians. I'm sure the opportunities for research and teaching play a role here, but I wonder, is it also, do you think that you have figured out how to make primary care practice a satisfying practice environment?
I think that what you just mentioned is indeed one of the factors. I think the other things apply as well: research, education, a stable practice environment, a practice environment where you can improve your career. We're a very good place for people to have a career in terms of moving forward or doing different things. And the third thing is that I think we have made, by giving them the right kinds of support and being able to pay competitive salaries, we have made primary care into a more attractive practice opportunity. And it's true that in general, except for some isolated places, that we don't have a lot of difficulty recruiting primary care providers.
Dr. Petzl, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
The things that I think people ought to be looking for, and that I think ought to characterize the way we practice medicine, is, number one, it should be patient-centered. And patient-centeredness means a number of things. It means that the whole system of care is set up around the needs of the patient, not necessarily the providers. So the hours the clinic is available, the kinds of services that it offers, the atmosphere, both the physical and the cultural atmosphere, are all aimed around the needs of the patient. And also, patient-centeredness means to me that the patients are in control of their health care. That is, they share in the decision-making. They make the decisions. We provide them with the advice and the information, but we have empowered them to the point where they have the knowledge to be able to participate in the decision-making process. There are a couple of other things that I think are important, but maybe not so important from the patient's perspective. And that is, I think that a health system ought to be looking at value. That is, are they providing both quality and cost-effective care? And I believe that a health system ought to be looking at the population implications of what they're doing, but not just at individual patient data, but also they should be following the data about the health of the population that they're treating.
Well, we have a lot of common ground there, and today we've been speaking with Dr. Robert Petzl, Undersecretary for Health in the Veterans Health Administration at the Department of Veteran Affairs. Dr. Petzl, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on very green approach to healing, gardening. Horticultural therapy programs are sprouting up in a number of healthcare facilities around the country, from hospitals to elderly care programs, crisis centers to mental health institutions. For instance, at Legacy Emmanuel Medical Center in Portland, Oregon, burn center patients get wheeled out regularly to their private garden. The garden is designed to stimulate the patient's senses and provide a soothing environment. This system of five nonprofit hospitals in the Portland area originally started a gardening club program for dementia patients in 1991. When they began seeing decreased anxiety and heightened concentration among these patients, they started using gardening as an integral part of the healthcare delivery. Today, there are 9 different therapeutic gardens at the hospital. As alternative approaches like horticultural therapy become more accepted, the research is also catching up. Several studies have shown how nature contributes to good health. In one study that appeared in 2008, 18 residents from an assisted living facility showed a significant increase in self-rated health and happiness after participating in 4 horticulture classes. Horticulture therapy is also an inexpensive approach. Although some facilities build elaborate gardens, all that really is needed is some potting soil and seeds. On top of that, practitioners say that in healthcare facilities, they can feel stressful and sterile. Gardens and plants offer important relief. It's a simple approach that can go a long way to help patients relieve stress, improve cognitive function, and even redevelop fine motor skills while at the same time greening the environment. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.